welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and we've got a fabulous journey ahead. I've entitled this show, Rare Finds, books that may not have been squarely on your radar, but are definitely worthy of your discovery. I've enlarged my research staff this week and asked respected friends and colleagues to share some of their favorite recent reads. And to add to the mix, our guest today offers up an intriguing glimpse into the world of rare books. He's an expert who shared his volumes of wisdom as a guest appraiser on Antiques Roadshow. So settle in for this tour of literary gems as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. With all the focus on Lincoln recently, I felt this title captured a fresh perspective. In Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker, Jennifer Cheverini presents a stunning account of the friendship between Mary Todd Lincoln and her seamstress, Elizabeth Lizzie Keckley, a former slave who outfitted the city's elite. She made history by sewing for Mary Todd Lincoln within the White House and became a trusted witness to private moments between the president and his wife. In March 1861, Mrs. Lincoln chose Keckley to create her gowns and to dress her. The relationship quickly evolved as Keckley was drawn into the intimate life of the Lincoln family, supporting Mary in the loss of her son and then her husband. Keckley saved scraps from dozens of gowns she made for Mrs. Lincoln, eventually piecing together a tribute known as the Mary Todd Lincoln Quilt. She also saved memories, which she fashioned into a book, Behind the Scenes, 30 years as a slave and 4 years in the White House. Upon its publication, Keckley's memoirs created a scandal, which compelled Mary Todd Lincoln to sever all ties with her. In the decades since, Keckley's story was all but forgotten. Cheverini brings this history to life in an impeccably researched, engrossing novel. Christina Moore narrates.
Virginia Lewis, her landlady and dear friend, must have seen her approach through the front window, for she met her at the door. "What's the news?" she asked, breathless, studying her expression as if to read the answer there. "I know how your ladies talk. If anyone knows what's happening, they would."
"I'm afraid they don't know any more than we do."
Elizabeth set down her sewing basket and unwrapped herself from her shawl.
"Nothing's changed from what we heard this morning. Mr. Lincoln's favored to win, but we won't know for a fact until they count the ballots."
"I suppose your ladies wouldn't care much for a President Lincoln."
"Not one bit. Most of their husbands like Mr. Breckinridge, and so they do likewise. A few of them like Mr. Bell, too."
Elizabeth lowered her voice conspiratorially.
"As for Mr. Lincoln, they fear he wants to free all the slaves."
They shared a laugh. "Well, then, God bless him," declared Virginia. "If that's true, I pray he wins."
Elizabeth nodded, but private doubts troubled her. No matter what the Southern partisans inhabiting the city said about Abraham Lincoln, as far as she knew, he had never promised to end slavery, only to keep it from spreading.
But even if he had placed his hand on a Bible and declared himself a staunch abolitionist, her few months in Washington had taught her that candidates often made promises that they found impossible to keep after taking office. Whatever Mr. Lincoln's intentions,
and whether they boded ill or good for Elizabeth and the Lewises and other colored folk, when Mr. Lincoln's people swept into the city to take over, most of Mr. Buchanan's would be swept out, among them the husbands of several of her best patrons. She could only hope that enough of them would remain behind to keep her business thriving. It was perhaps too much to hope that the new First Lady would have a taste for finery, and that Elizabeth might somehow attract her notice. It was well after midnight when she was startled awake by the sounds of shouting on the street outside, of jubilant songs and speeches, and soon thereafter of the firing of pistols and shattering of windows. She sat up in bed and strained her ears in the darkness, sifting scents from the jumble of noise and fury until she understood that the votes had been counted, the result announced. Abraham Lincoln would become the 16th President of the United States. When Elizabeth had first arrived in Washington, she had no money, no friends, no place to call home. But she had soon found work as an assistant seamstress for $2.50 a day and took a room in a boarding house. Before long, she decided to strike out on her own, and she had a sign and business cards made. She advertised herself as a skilled mantua maker, capable of sewing the complicated, snug-fitting bodice of the style that well-dressed ladies most desired. Slowly but surely, she acquired a few patrons who recommended her to their friends and acquaintances. One generous lady, a friend of the mayor, persuaded him to waive the fee for the license that, like all free Negro females over the age of 14, Elizabeth was required to obtain within 30 days of her arrival if she wished to remain in the city. And she had already decided that she did wish to stay, even though the daily sight of slaves in chains being led through the muddy streets from shipyard to auction house, and the restrictions upon freedmen like the license and curfews, sometimes made her feel as if she were not truly free. In October, a few weeks before the election that threw Washington City into uproar, Elizabeth sewed a gown for the wife of the cavalry officer, Colonel Robert E. Lee. "Spare no expense," the colonel had urged Elizabeth as he entrusted her with $100 to purchase lace and buttons and ribbons for his wife's attire. Elizabeth gladly did as he bade her, and when Mrs. Lee wore the gown to a private dinner party at the White House in honor of the Prince of Wales, the other ladies in attendance were so impressed by the gown's beauty and elegance and excellent fit that they sought out Elizabeth's services. Her reputation grew as one delighted patron after another recommended her to their friends, and soon she had almost more work than she could handle.
We've just heard Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker by Jennifer Chavarini. This find came from Dave Hain, the artiste who puts the book report together each week. I thought it was a natural, perhaps supernatural, compliment to the title we've just previewed, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter by Seth Graham Smith. In 1818 Indiana, Abraham Lincoln kneels at his suffering mother's bedside. She's been stricken with something old-timers call milk sickness. Later, the grieving Abe learns his mother's fatal affliction was actually the work of a vampire. In response, the young Lincoln writes in his journal, "Henceforth, my life shall be one of rigorous study and devotion. I shall become a master of mind and body, and this mastery shall have but one purpose." Gifted with legendary height, strength, and skill with an axe, Abe sets out on a path of vengeance that will lead him all the way to the White House. While Abraham Lincoln is widely lauded for saving the Union and freeing millions of slaves, his valiant fight against the forces of the undead has remained in shadows for hundreds of years. Until now. Scott Holst narrates.
I finished reading the last page, looked over my shoulder to make sure I was still alone, and turned back to the first. I had to read it again. Right now, before reason turned its dogs on the dangerous beliefs that were beginning to march through my mind. The little book began with these seven absurd, fascinating words. This is the Journal of Abraham Lincoln. Rhinebeck is one of those upstate towns that time forgot, a town where family-owned shops and familiar faces line the streets, and the oldest inn in America, where, as any townie will proudly tell you, General Washington himself once laid his wigless head, still offers its comforts at reasonable prices. It's a town where people give each other homemade quilts and use wood stoves to heat their homes, and where I have witnessed, on more than one occasion, an apple pie cooling on a windowsill. The place belongs in a snow globe. Like most of Rhinebeck, the Five and Dime on East Market Street is a living piece of a dying past. Since 1946, the locals have depended on it for everything from egg timers to hem tape to pencils to Christmas toys. "If we don't sell it, you don't need it," boasts the sun-beaten sign in the front window. "And if you need it anyway, we'll order it." Inside, between checkered linoleum and unflattering fluorescence, you'll find all the sundries of earth-bursting organized by bin. Prices written in grease pencil. Debit cards begrudgingly accepted. This was my home from 8:30 in the morning to 5:30 at night. 6 days a week, every week. I'd always known I'd end up in the store after graduation, just like I had every summer since I was 15. I wasn't family in the strictest sense, but Jan and Al had always treated me like one of their kids, giving me a job when I needed it most, throwing me a little pocket money while I was away at school. The way I saw it, I owed them 6 solid months, June through Christmas. That was the plan. 6 months of working in the store by day and working on my novel nights and weekends. Plenty of time to finish the first draft and give it a good polish. Manhattan was only an hour and a half by train, and that's where I'd go when I was done, with 4 or 5 pounds of unsolicited, proofread opportunity under my arm. Goodbye, Hudson Valley. Hello, lecture circuit. 9 years later, I was still in the store. Somewhere in the middle of getting married, surviving a car accident, having a baby, abandoning my novel, starting and abandoning 6 others, having another baby, and trying to stay on top of the bills, something wholly unexpected and depressingly typical happened. I stopped caring about my writing and started caring about everything else. The kids, the marriage, the mortgage, the store. I seethed at the sight of locals shopping at the CVS down the street. I bought a computer to help track inventory. Mostly I looked for new ways to bring people through the door. When the used bookstore in Red Hook closed, I bought some of their stock and put a lending shelf in the back. Raffles, clearance sales, Wi-Fi, anything to get them through that door. Every year I tried something new. And every year, we barely scraped by. Henry, footnote, not the name he went by at the time. For the sake of consistency, I referred to him by his actual name throughout the book, including here. Had been coming for a year or so before we got around to talking. We'd exchanged the expected pleasantries, nothing more. "Have a good one. See you next time." I only knew his name because I'd heard it through the Market Street grapevine. The story was he'd bought one of the bigger places off of Route 9G and had an army of local handymen sprucing it up. He was a little younger than me, maybe 27 or so, with messy dark hair, a year-round tan, and a different pair of sunglasses for every occasion. I could tell he was money. His clothes screamed it. Vintage T-shirts, wool blazers, jeans that cost more than my car. But he wasn't like the other money that came in. Weekenders who like to gush about our cute little town and our adorable little store, walking right past our "no food or drink, please" sign with their oversized cups of hazelnut coffee and never spending a dime.
That was a sampling of Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, by Seth Graham Smith. Ken Gloss, my guest today, is the current proprietor of the Brattle Bookshop. The shop was founded in 1825 and has been in the hands of the Gloss family since 1949. Ken started working for his dad, George, when he was 5, and it's rumored that his first words as a baby was "book." Ken has been at the shop full-time since 1973. Housed in the heart of downtown Boston, the Brattle Bookshop has over 250,000 books, maps, prints, postcards, and ephemera in all subjects. It's one of the largest antiquarian bookshops in the country. In addition to its general used and out-of-print stock, the shop also maintains an inventory of collectibles, first editions, and fine bindings in its rare book room. Ken is a past president of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America's New England chapter. He appraises books in libraries for Harvard, Boston University, Boston College, the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, the FBI, and others. And he appears as a guest appraiser on the Antiques Roadshow on PBS. He's written numerous articles on books, book collecting, and selling. Welcome, Ken. It's a real treat to have you with us on the Book Report today.
Well, I'm happy to be talking with you, and at least I can talk about older books this time as opposed to the new ones.
All right. Well, we all have boxes of books in our attic. Before carting them out the door, what should we look for? What are the telltale signs that a book might be rare and valuable?
Well, there's a lot of things. Well, first of all, most of the books you have in the attic probably aren't terribly valuable. So the bestsellers, the novels that you've read, the authors that are well known, most of them come out in large quantities, and, you know, they're good books, but because they're good books, they sold huge quantities. Usually some of the things to look for, at least in the literature, would be the author's first book, you know, before they were well known, because before they were well known, people didn't save them. The publishers put out relatively small numbers, and so that's one thing. Also, when you get to really old books, I mean, things getting back 100 to 300 years or more, is the book contemporary to what it's about? I mean, if you have a book in the American Revolution and it's in the 1880s or 1890s, it might be over 100 years old, but it's well over 100 years after the fact. So sort of look for, is it about something that's contemporary to the era? And then, of course, is it signed by someone famous? And I could go on and on and on with all the little nuances that make the difference between a book that might be a couple of dollars and one that might be into the thousands of dollars.
Is there a database of valuable books somewhere we could check online?
Well, they're online. There are databases, things, there's Amazon, there's a site called Book Finder, there's ABE Books, there's a whole load of them. The problem with those sites is they're unedited. In other words, anyone can put anything on at any price, at any request, any description, and nobody checks it. So it's sort of, I liken it to, it's a great tool if you know what you're doing when you start. And then, of course, there are people like myself. There's an organization called the Antiquarian Bookmen's Association of America. If you Google it, it will turn up. And there are book dealers that have been in business for years. And one of the things that you tend to find about people, and most book dealers are like this, that love what they do, ask them a question. It's not a problem getting an answer. It's getting them to stop answering. And so a lot of times, you know, I'd say call a reputable person, myself, others in the area, ask, and, you know, more often than not, you'll at least get steered in the right direction or get a direct answer.
Well, that brings up this question. If a person doesn't live in a large metro area, how can they find out the worth of a book? Can they take photographs and send it to you, for example?
Well, nowadays, yes, absolutely. Matter of fact, a lot of times what I tell people now, they can send photographs, they can send lists, they can call. A lot of it I can do on the phone. They can old-fashioned mail. But, you know, nowadays, specific books, we get emails all the time with photographs of books, signatures. Is it real? Is it what it's supposed to be? Just the other day, we had someone who had a rare, rare book signed by Abraham Lincoln. The only problem was it was signed by a forger.
Oh.
And we could even tell him which forger of Abraham Lincoln did it. And other times, we've had people, you know, send photographs, speaking of Lincoln, that were worth $50,000, $100,000. Mm-hmm. So that's one way. The other thing that people sometimes do is if you have a large library of books and you can see the spines, a lot of times a couple of photos, you can have 50, 100 books in a photo, and at least a good book dealer, myself and others, can look at that and say, you know, the library you have really isn't going to be that valuable. Or from what we're seeing, we really really need to go through it book by book, and it's a good way to start the conversation.
I've often wondered about colored plates inside an older book. Should you ever take them out and have them appraised separately?
Well, that's a question that I can stand on one side of the question, argue one way, then jump to the other side of the line, argue it the other way, and make a very convincing argument. You know, when people go to old print shops and they buy Audubon prints, for instance, every one of those came out of a book. Most of the old maps that you buy, they all came out of books. My general feeling with that is, if you have a book that's somewhat damaged, has beautiful, beautiful either 19th, 20th, 18th century plates, and you can get the plates out of them, great. On the other hand, if you have a book that is so rare that there might only be one or two copies around, it's a real tragedy to break it up. But, you know, something like Audubon, a set of Audubon, an average set can cost $50,000, $100,000 on the low end. A plate can cost $200, $300, $500, so it's a way of owning an original that actually makes more people able to buy it. So, but again, it depends on what the book is, who the illustrator is, what the pictures are, how rare it is, and all of those things go into should it be broken up. And part of it, in the large numbers, is what you enjoy and what you have fun with and what you like. I mean, they're your items, and books are meant to be enjoyed.
Give us a glimpse into the rare book room at your shop.
You can get, you know, books signed by Jefferson, Lincoln, Einstein. You can get old maps going back to the 1700s, 1800s. You can get the first editions of Dickens and Thoreau. And, you know, one of the things that's a lot of fun about a used and rare bookstore is you can come in and maybe you started out looking for one subject, but the book next to it actually catches your interest and can lead you in a whole different direction. So it's sort of the serendipity of looking.
Share some of your biggest finds or one of your biggest finds on the Antiques Roadshow.
There was a lady, and I found this one fascinating. It was in Nebraska, and her grandmother and grandfather had built the only Frank Lloyd Wright house in Nebraska. And she, in the early 1900s, acted as the general contractor. So they had all of the drawings, his original drawings, they had all of the correspondence, all of the detailing of materials. And one thing I loved about it, you knew that it was early in his career, because his grandmother, and of course the grandmother being a general contractor at that time, was a really tough position, bossing around a lot of, you know, men and so on. One of the things that was great, though, she wrote to Frank Lloyd Wright, said, "Your initial drawings are awful. I hate them. Redo them." And he redid them. Now, later in his career, he would have told her, you know, he would have told her, to, you know, no way, you know, who are you? But he redid them. And one of the things that's great about the Antiques Roadshow is not only that material, which was up into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, but a lot of it is the story that goes with it, and the guest was excited, and so that made it a lot of fun.
Are there any rare paperbacks, or are there only hardcover books that have great value?
Oh, no. Well, of course, then you get into the definition of paperbacks. I mean, back in 1827, there was a little paperback pamphlet called Tamerlane by a Bostonian. Bostonian did it was Edgar Allan Poe. It was his first book. It was terrible. It was an awful. It was a long poem. It was terrible. Most of them got destroyed. If you got a copy of that now, it'd be close to $1 million. But it's just paper covered. But I think what you're really talking about is probably what we consider the paperbacks. And people collect the, like, ones from the 40s, 50s, for those gory covers, you know, a woman's dead on the ground with a revealing dress, maybe a bloody knife over her. And people love collecting those graphically. Also, especially in the mysteries and science fiction, a lot of the great authors, you know, that was the first edition of their work, and they can go into the hundreds of dollars occasionally.
Okay, so you're standing in line in a bookstore, and you're waiting to have your book signed by a contemporary famous author. I've heard it's better not to have a book inscribed to you personally, that this could diminish the value down the line.
Well, that comes a lot from sports card collecting and sports collectibles, and that they definitely don't. You know, if you have a baseball card of Ted Williams and it's signed to Ken, you know, maybe something I got, and, you know, they don't like it if the name's on it, because if someone else's name, they don't like it. But in books, my feeling is, first of all, by the time the people are doing tours, it's probably a little later in their career. They're probably large numbers of the books. But authors are famous because they write. And my feeling is the more you can get them to write, the better. Also, 99% of them aren't going to be valuable. So it should be more a memory for you. In other words, you can look back 10 years later and I met, you know, Alex or, you know, Paul Thoreau. I met, you know, this great person, this writer that I love, and it can bring back that memory. And if they write and add Miami Beach 2013, or if they add a stanza of a poem or so on, they're known for writing. I like to get them to write the more the better. And the few that do turn out valuable, usually the more they write, the higher the price.
All right. Well, this is great information. Tell us again how a reader out in the hinterlands can reach you with a question.
Well, we have a website. It's brattlebookshop.com. And we have an 800 number. It's 800-447-9595.
Speaking with you has been quite the treasure hunt today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
All righty. Bye. As I've shared before, my early professional years were spent at the Library of Congress. No surprise, then, that I've asked one of my library pals for his recommendation for a rare find show. He shared a selection from his book group, one they truly enjoyed, Eva Braun, Life with Hitler, by German historian Heike B. Gortemacher. It's perhaps the first comprehensive biography of Eva Braun. Reviewers have called it an authoritative reassessment of Braun's role in Hitler's life. Drawing upon newly discovered documents, Gortemacher presents a revealing portrait of the Führer and his inner circle and carefully distinguishes fact from fiction. Suzanne Torin narrates.
Even before 1914, Heinrich Hoffmann had made a name for himself with the public and in artistic circles with his photography service, the Hoffmann Photo Report, as well as by taking portrait photographs. Still, he owed his flourishing business to the NSDAP. After World War I, which he spent on the French front as a reservist in a replacement detachment of the Air Force, he put his talents at the service of the far-right nationalist movement that was rising to power, the Nazi Party's house photographer. It is no longer possible to reconstruct exactly when and in what circumstances Hoffmann met Hitler for the first time. Hoffmann's daughter, Henriette von Schirach, later claimed that the populist poet and writer Dietrich Eckart had put her father in contact with Hitler. Hoffmann himself said in his memoir that their first encounter was for purely business reasons, after an American photo agency offered him $100 for a photograph of Hitler on October 30, 1922. As early as 1947, in an unpublished written statement in his own defense, Hoffmann claimed that the American press had offered him a large sum for the first picture of Hitler at the time. In order to get this money, under any circumstances, he contrived a seemingly chance encounter by suggesting that Hermann Esse, a good friend of Hitler's, hold the reception for his upcoming wedding in Hoffmann's house on July 5, 1923. In this way, he planned to meet Hitler, who was to be one of the witnesses at the ceremony. In fact, Hoffmann had been a member of the German Workers' Party, the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, or DAP, since April 6, 1920, 6 months after Hitler had joined. Anton Drexler had founded the party in January of the previous year in Munich, and it had recently changed its name to the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP. Hoffmann began to publish the weekly newspaper Auf gut Deutsch, in good German, edited by the radical, nationalistic, and anti-Semitic Dietrich Eckart, Hitler's friend, mentor, and father figure. This failed poet used the paper to rail against the Weimar Republic, Bolshevism, and Judaism, under the motto, Germany Awake. There is much evidence to suggest that Hoffmann became friends with this circle of like-minded men, including Eckart, Hitler, and the journalist Hermann Essel, before he began to make himself useful to the NSDAP, and especially to the man who became its leader starting on July 29, 1921, the aggressive beer hall agitator Adolf Hitler. Despite numerous requests, Hoffmann at first respected Hitler's wish not to be photographed. Hoffmann's first portrait of Hitler, in fact, appeared only after the failed beer hall putsch of November 8th to 9th, 1923, which made Hitler famous throughout Germany, but also landed him in jail. The following year, Hoffmann published a photo brochure titled Germany's Awakening in Words and Pictures. In 1926, the tireless Hoffmann, together with Hitler and Hermann Essel, their mutual friend and the first head of propaganda for the party, founded a richly illustrated weekly party newspaper, the Illustrierte Beobachter.
We've just heard Eva Braun, Life with Hitler, by Heikki Gortemacher. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. I know Derek Hewitt, executive producer of The Book Report, hails from South Africa. Swashbuckling books about his continent always seem to top his list. He proposes for your enjoyment Bartle Bull's The White Rhino Hotel, book one of the Anton Ryder trilogy. The Great War has ended, tragically for many, but for some, East Africa holds the prospect of vast estates, fabulous wealth, and limitless opportunity. At Lord Penfold's White Rhino Hotel in colonial Kenya, paths of new settlers are always intersecting. We are introduced to a memorable cast of characters, the cunning Olivio Alevado, a man with lustful desires, Anton Ryder, the gypsy adventurer, and the courageous war-hardened Gwen Llewellyn. At the White Rhino, hope is corrupted by greed, love by revenge, and loyalty by betrayal. Fred Williams performs the book that the Boston Globe called a wing-ding adventure story, the kind of book that creates one of the elemental delights of fiction, a complete other world where, unlike our own, all the parts add up to something.
One sturdy table remained in place in the center of the room, exactly straddling the equator. A narrow trench cut its square surface. The dwarf stroked both ears with his fingers and recalled a long evening some years before the war. Lord Penfold, the hotel's proprietor, then in younger, stronger days, had raised a panga and slammed the heavy blade down to mark the middle of the world. As the Lord remarked that night, the White Rhino was the only bar where one enjoyed a drink in one hemisphere and got rid of it in the other. Olivio heard a whistle blast call to him from an upstairs room as a man blew into the empty brass cartridge of a 7mm Mauser. The barman drew the last bottle of champagne from the cold locker, selected a rhinoceros hide tray, and gathered a bottle of stout and two glasses. Then he ascended the stairs to the guest hall, pulling on the rail with one small hand. The keyhole of number 3 welcomed the dwarf's eye at just the proper level, and not by accident. He thought back to the day the carpenters had asked him how high to set the keyholes. He placed his right eye comfortably against the small, familiar opening. "Not now, Shorty," an American voice said. "Just set down the black velvet. Go spy on Spongy next door. What's going on in there would blind a camel."
"Yes, Sahib Slider."
Olivio moved to number 4. He opened his eye wide and set it to the door. Two white robes were scattered on the floor. A musical tinkling as of 1,000 tiny bells thrilled his ear. The black tulips, he thought. He moistened his lips and angled his head to catch sight of the bed. He was eager to study their work while the exquisite Somali twins performed their tantalizing specialty, leaving their client exhilarated and exhausted, without permitting penetration. A boot crashed against the inside door handle, bruising the dwarf's temple. He heard a voice whine, "Off with you, you twisted little brute!" From long experience in the Bombay Club and in British East Africa, Olivio knew it was time to withdraw. The English were sensitive about their relations with these Africans, as well they might be. Vengeance would come later. Like most Goans, Olivio Fonseca Alavedo took a long view. The Portuguese had occupied his own land, the island enclave of Goa on the coast of India, for over 4 centuries. One day they would leave. In the meantime, he would reward this rude Englishman, Mr. Spongy Hartshorn, in his own way. Only the English, Olivio reflected, would build this wretched hotel in the hills of central Kenya, a refuge for every red-eyed farmer and philandering ivory hunter from Nairobi to Abyssinia. What could such people know of civilization? With only 2,000 Goans in all of British East Africa, Olivio and his countrymen had built one of the first stone buildings in Nairobi, the Goan Institute. While these English farmers 350 years ago were shivering in damp huts in their own country, huddled under thatched roofs like black savages, the masters of the Inquisition were purifying Western India. Olivio's own father, he recalled with pride, was almost certainly the bastard son of Dom Tiago de Castañeda y Fonseca, the late Archbishop of Goa. Olivio imagined his distant relatives, powerful and rich, not aware of his existence, going about their privileged lives in Portugal. The dwarf dreamt what his legacy might be.
That was The White Rhino Hotel by Bartle Bull. I had the pleasure of interviewing Stephen Hunter on March 3rd of last year. When we spoke then, he shared his next project was to be about the Kennedy assassination. And here it is, climbing up the bestseller lists. I could not be happier for him. In the third bullet, number 8 in the series, legendary former Marine sniper Bob Lee Swagger begins to ponder the events of November 22, 1963, and the third bullet that so decisively ended the life of JFK and set the stage for one of the most enduring controversies of our time. He's asking questions few have asked before. Why did the third bullet explode? Why did Lee Harvey Oswald, about to become the most hunted man on earth, risk it all by returning to his rooming house to secure a pistol he could have brought with him? How could a conspiracy that went unpenetrated for 50 years been thrown together in the 2.5 days between the announcement of the president's route and the assassination? As Bob investigates, another voice enters the narrative, Hugh Meacham, veteran of the CIA Plans Division. Meacham has secrets and the means to keep them buried. As each man hunts for the other, Third Bullet builds to a climax that proves it's never too late for justice. Buck Scherner narrates.
The sidewalk before him bucked and heaved, blown askew by high winds howling through the night. Oh, wait. No, let's edit that. There was no bucking and heaving. Ditto with the blown askew and the high winds howling through the night. It just seemed so to Eptaptin, because the winds that toyed with the stability of the sidewalk blew, howled, only through his own mind. They were zephyrs of vodka, and they'd substantially loosened his grip on the solidity of the little chunk of earth that lay between the bar he'd just exited and the house where he lived a few hundred yards ahead. Eptaptin, alcoholic, writer, success, melancholiac, and gun guy, was in a zone that might be called greater than a buzz but less than a full staggering drunk. He was one sheet to the wind, you might say. Happy, 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 as three vodka martinis will do to a fellow with only moderate capacity for drink. And what lay ahead, although slightly challenging, didn't really seem insurmountable. After all, he had to walk only another few feet, cross the street, and then... Digression. Pause for autobiographical interlude. It's allowed when under the influence. One thing suggests another, and in this case the suggestion is appropriate. The street was called Light, and that suggested a kind of hopeful conclusion to the evening. Light as in light of heart, light of spirit, light at end of tunnel. Light as in amusing, fey, witty. Light as symbol of hope and life. But also, light as in light for all. A famous newspaper, located a mile or so up the very same Light Street, had proclaimed on a daily basis for 175 years or so, 26 of which he'd spent in its employ, and where his wife to this day toiled. Yes, he was that James Eptaptin, minor local journo celeb, who'd gone on to minor fame as a writer for money of hardcover books about gunfights and the stoic heroes who won them. And now he found himself at 65, improbably successful, in a small way, and awkwardly pleased to be himself. He had it all. Beautiful wife, a couple of mil, a nice house in a fabulous part of town, a minor reputation, enough to take some pleasure in, a grand future, a munificent multi-book contract, a really cool project ahead, and a lot of guns. The reason for the three vodka martinis was liberation, not celebration. His wife was absent. Ha ha ha, too bad for her. She was at some newsroom woman thing, birthday party maybe. Why did women take birthdays so seriously, by the way? And so he'd wandered on his own to the nearby bistro, had a burger with a bud, and then V1, which weakened his resolve to resist V2, which shattered his resolve to resist V3. Fortunately, there'd been no V4, or he'd be asleep in the men's room. Now, where was I before digression? What place is this? Where am I now? Ha 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 ha. Oh, yes. Home is the hunter. He was walking home. The street slanted, then rolled. Ahead it humped up, then dipped down to permit a view of the valley. It rocked, it rolled, it shook, it rattled, it coiled, it double-bubbled, boiled, and troubled. He laughed. "Do you find yourself amusing?" his wife always asked, and the truth was, yes, he did find himself amusing. The mood, like the geography, chemically amplified by red potato crushed by Kulak descendants, was quite good.
We've just heard The Third Bullet by Stephen Hunter. The most original writers of his generation, George Saunders is an undisputed master of the short story. The 10th of December is his most honest, accessible, and moving collection to date. In Victory Lap, the opening tale, a boy witnesses the attempted abduction of the girl next door, and he's faced with a harrowing choice. Does he ignore what he sees, or override years of smothering advice from his parents and act? In Home, a combat-damaged soldier moves back with his mother and struggles to reconcile the world he left with the one to which he's returned. And in the title story, a middle-aged cancer patient walks into the woods to commit suicide, only to encounter a troubled young boy who, over the course of a fateful morning, gives the dying man a chance to recall who he really is. The author narrates.
The hunter, captivated by her beauty, doffed his cap and, going down on one knee, said, "If I could will life back into this fawn, I would do so, in hopes you might defer one tender kiss upon our elderly forehead." "Go," she said, "only, for your task of penance, do not eat her. Lay her out in a field of clover with roses strewn about her, and bestow a choir to softly sing of her foul end."
"Lay who out?"
the baby deer said. "No one," she said. "Never mind. Stop asking so many questions." "Padishah, padishah, changement, changement." She felt hopeful that special one would hail from far away. The local boys possessed a certain je ne sais quoi, which she had overheard that, and aspired to work for county power because the work shirts were awesome and you got them free. So, ixnay on the local boys. A special ixnay on Matt Dre, owner of the largest mouth in the land. Kissing him last night at the pep rally had been like kissing an underpass. Scary. Kissing Matt was like suddenly this cow in a sweater is bearing down on you, who will not take no for an answer, and his huge cow head is being flooded by chemicals that are drowning out what little powers of reason Matt actually did have. What she liked was being in charge of her. Her body, her mind, her thoughts, her career, her future. That was what she liked. So be it. We might have a slight snack. Un petit repas. Was she special? Did she consider herself special? Oh, gosh, she didn't know. In the history of the world, many had been more special than her. Helen Keller had been awesome. Mother Teresa was amazing. Mrs. Roosevelt was quite chipper, in spite of her husband, who was handicapped, which, in addition, she had been gay with those big old teeth. Long before such time as being gay and First Lady was even conceptual, she, Allison, could not hope to compete in the category of those ladies. Not yet, anyway. There was so much she didn't know, like how to change the oil, or even check the oil, how to open the hood, how to bake brownies. That was embarrassing, actually, being a girl and all. And what was a mortgage? Did it come with the house? When you breastfed, did you have to, like, push the milk out? Egads, who is this wan figure visible through the living room window? Trotting up Gladsong Drive. Kyle Boot, palest kid in all the land, still dressed in his weird cross-country toggles. Poor thing, he looked like a skeleton with a mullet. Were those cross-country shorts from the, like, Charlie's Angels days or qua? How could he run so well when he seemed to have literally no muscles? Every day he ran home like this, shirtless with his backpack on, then hit the remote from down by the fungs and scooted into his garage without breaking stride. He almost had to admire the poor goof. They'd grown up together, been little beaners in that mutual sandbox down by the creek. Hadn't they bathed together when we or some such crud? She hoped that never got out. Because in terms of friends, Kyle was basically down to Fetty Slavko, who walked leaning way backward and was always retrieving things from between his teeth, announcing the name of the retrieved thing in Greek, then re-eating it. Kyle's mom and dad didn't let him do squat. He had to call home if the movie in World Culture might show bare boobs. Each of the items in his lunchbox was clearly labeled. Pas de bourrée and curtsy. Poor quantity of cheese doodles in the compartmentalized old-school Tupperware dealy. Thanks, Mom. Thanks, Dad. Your kitchen rocks.
We've just heard The 10th of December by George Saunders. Knows what it's like to be a child soldier, a factory worker, and a political prisoner. To be deported with barely enough money for a plane ticket to a bewildering new land. To start all over without family or friends as a maid, waitress, and student. Ping Fu also knows what it's like to be a pioneering software programmer, an innovator, a CEO, and Inc. Magazine's Entrepreneur of the Year. It sounds unbelievable, but Bend Not Break, A Life in Two Worlds by Ping Fu and Mei Mei Fox is all true. Born on the eve of China's Cultural Revolution, Ping was separated from her family at age 8. She grew up fighting hunger and humiliation and shielding her younger sister from Mao's Red Guard. At 25, she found her way to the U.S. Her only resources were $80 in traveler's checks and three phrases of English: thank you, hello, and help. Ping persevered, and the hard-won lessons guided her to success. A love of problem solving led her to computer science, and Ping became part of the team that became Netscape. She then started GeoMagic, a company that finds solutions for challenges as varied as prosthetic limbs to repairing NASA spaceships. Robin Miles narrates.
When we were airborne, the flight attendant came by, wheeling a cart. She was an American with blonde hair, blue eyes, and a warm smile. In English, she asked me if I wanted something to eat or drink. I didn't understand her, since I knew how to say only hello, thank you, and help. But I guessed at her intention. I presumed that the refreshments would cost money, so I waved my hand in a gesture that said no, hugging Shanghai Mama's tin pan even tighter on my lap. Then I pointed toward the cocktail napkins piled high at the edge of the cart, and the stewardess wordlessly handed me a large stack. For hours, I scribbled Chinese characters onto the thin squares of paper, placing one after another at the corner of my tray, like miniature flags of surrender. I did not intend to share these notes. Journaling had proved comforting to me since I was a child. The act of recording my thoughts gave the illusion of having a conversation with a trusted friend, when in truth I now had none. I landed in San Francisco 14 hours later, jet-lagged and emotionally drained. The airport amazed me. It glittered like a jewel with its multiple-story-tall windows and sparkling cleanliness. As soon as I had cleared immigration, I sought out the ticket counter. I was en route to Albuquerque, where I was registered to study English as a second language at the University of New Mexico. Although I had exactly $80 in traveler's checks to pay for the connecting flight, the airline staff refused to issue me a ticket. I couldn't understand why. That had been the price when I had checked in Shanghai. Bless San Francisco. There was a Mandarin-speaking agent behind the counter who understood my problem. In China, the government sets prices, so ticket prices rarely changed. But here in America, prices changed frequently, she explained. The ticket price has increased since you left Shanghai. You are $5 short. I didn't have $5, a credit card, or a number to call for help. As I stood there silently, an American man waiting behind me in line asked us what the problem was. When the desk agent explained my predicament, he took a $5 bill out of his wallet. "Here you go," he said, flashing an easy smile. The ticket agent translated. "Thank you," I replied in English, surprised that a stranger would help me. The gesture may not have meant much to him, but it meant the world to me. My first impression of Americans, and one that endures to this day, was that they are warm, giving people. The experience offered me this life lesson: when in doubt, always err on the side of generosity. It is a value that I've held dear to my heart ever since. When I got to Albuquerque, I found myself stranded once again. My father had given me the name of Mr. Sheng, a former student of his who was studying at the University of New Mexico, and had helped my family to get me accepted there. I called him collect several times, but the phone rang endlessly. I waited, hoping eventually I'd reach this stranger who was my only U.S. contact. I had nowhere else to turn. Later, I learned that Mr. Sheng had graduated from UNM a few weeks before I arrived and was touring America before returning to China. As I sat on the curb outside the luggage claim with my one large, tattered bag, I watched the cars coming and going. The popping sound of car trunks opening unnerved me. No one seemed to notice me. They were all too busy leaving the airport or coming here to pick up their loved ones. It reminded me of the day when I was 8 years old that I left Shanghai by train and arrived at the Nanjing station alone. The feelings of loss hit me hard, and I began to cry. A car pulled up in front of me some time later. When I looked up with hazy eyes, I saw a Chinese man sitting in the driver's seat. He rolled down the window slowly. "Do you need help?" the man asked, speaking in Mandarin, with a thick accent that I couldn't place. "Yes," I said. "I needed a ride to the University of New Mexico campus." "Get in," he said, waving his hand toward the passenger seat. "I'll take you there."
That was Bend Not Break, A Life in Two Worlds by Ping Fu and Mei Mei Fox. My excessive love of travel. So I've selected Simon Garfield's On the Map as our final gem today. From the author who brought us Just My Type, this new book is a wonderfully entertaining look at how maps chart our understanding of the world. From the early sketches of philosophers and explorers through to Google Maps and beyond, maps both relate and realign our history. Garfield's narratives range from the quest to create the perfect globe to the challenges of mapping Africa and Antarctica, from spellbinding treasure maps to rare map dealers and cartographic frauds. Simon Shepherd narrates this witty examination of where we've been, how we got there, and where we're going.
Maps began as a challenge of the imagination, and they still perform that role. So, imagine yourself in your bedroom. How good would you be at mapping it? Given a pencil and pad, could you draw the room well enough so that someone who's never been there would get a fair picture? Would the size of the bed be in proportion to the door in the bedside table? Would the scale be right in relation to the height of the ceiling? Would your kitchen be harder or easier to map than the bedroom? This shouldn't be too hard, really, because these are places you know well. But what about the living room of a friend? That would be partly a test of memory. Would you get it right? Or would you be struggling? But what about your first school? Would you remember where your classroom was in relation to others? Or the world? Could you draw that? Could you correlate the relative size and geographic relationship of Mongolia and Switzerland? Would you get the oceans even half right in the southern hemisphere? And what if you'd never seen another map before, or a globe, and you'd never been to any of these places yourself? Could you construct a map of the world based purely on what people had told you and what people had written down? And if you did manage this, would you be happy for it still to be used as the principal map of the world some 1,350 years after you had drawn it? Only, I imagine, if your name was Claudius Ptolemy. Considering his impact on the world and beyond the fact that we should regard the P in his surname as silent, we know curiously little about Ptolemy, but we do know where he worked, at one of the greatest buildings in ancient Egypt, lying just a little way inland on a small cloak-shaped port on the banks of the Mediterranean. The story of the vanished Great Library of Alexandria is one of the most romantic of the ancient world, and it appeals partly because we're unable to imagine a modern equivalent. Today's British Library is a library of record, receiving a copy of each new work in the English language. But it has no ambitions to house a complete collection of the world's manuscripts, nor to contain the sum of human knowledge. The same with the Bodleian in Oxford and the New York Public Library. But the Great Library of Alexandria did aspire to such ambitions, and it existed at a time when such a thing was broadly achievable.
We've just heard On the Map by Simon Garfield. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed this exploration, one that ranged all across the literary map. Many thanks to friends and colleagues for their recommendations, and thanks to you for joining me today. send me a note at elaine@bookreportradio.com and let me know your favorite rare finds. Let's meet again in 1 week for the next edition of The Book Report.